Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with As It Is. We come your way 7 days a week with interesting and important news about things happening all around us. At the same time, we give you the opportunity to learn and improve your American English. Today, we begin with a trip back in time. Some people at the University of California are giving all of us a chance to study an important time in American history in an unusual way. Then, it's something that many people do not recognize as a problem in America. But many people in this country do not have food security. What does that mean? We'll tell you in about 5 minutes. Let's get started with part one. The 1960s was a time of change in the United States and other places. These changes influenced opinions about social issues and extended to politics and even science. Internet users can now hear this period of history through the YouTube website. Visitors can listen to leading Americans and others who spoke 40 or more years ago at the University of California, Los Angeles. Their recorded speeches were forgotten for years until recently. Christopher Cruz has the story.
The University of California, Los Angeles, recorded hundreds of people who spoke at UCLA in the 1960s and early 1970s. Some speakers were from the motion picture industry in nearby Hollywood. Others included world leaders and even astronauts. Tim Groling is chairman of the university's communications department. He says the audio, or sound, recordings are from an important period in history.
It's the combination of this being, I think, dramatic figures, speaking at what was really a dramatic time. I mean, this is a time period where society is really changing.
The recordings were left in storage areas and forgotten until recently, when Tim Groling discovered an old tape player by chance.
I was at a thrift store and saw an old reel-to-reel unit for $20 that I'm like, I bet you that fits with the tapes, and $20, might as well give it a shot.
He bought the tape player from the store. Then he asked a former student, Derek Bolin, to help make digital versions of the recordings.
I felt very good about doing this because I felt like I was preserving a piece of history.
Derek Bolin made digital copies of the speeches recorded between 1962 and 1973. In this 1972 speech, actress Jane Fonda spoke at an anti-Vietnam War protest.
At a time when there are 400,000 people in prison in South Vietnam for speaking out for peace, independence, and democracy in South Vietnam, I think the least we can do is to close down our schools and universities.
Another recording has the voice of Yitzhak Rabin. He spoke at the university while he was the Israeli ambassador to the United States. He later became prime minister and was murdered in 1995. The speeches covered subjects other than world politics. The developer of the polio vaccine, Jonas Salk, gave a speech at UCLA in 1972. He described that period of time as important in the history of science.
The world is going through very interesting changes now and changes of such nature that I believe that this is perhaps the most interesting time that man has ever lived, and perhaps is more interesting than will ever be true again in the future.
Tim Groling says that without technology and the internet, it would be difficult for people to hear these men and women. 366 of the speeches given at UCLA are now available on the YouTube website. I'm Christopher Cruz.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The United States Department of Agriculture has released a report on the problems that Americans have getting food. The report says that 1 in 7 U.S. families last year did not have food security, the ability to get healthy food. This rate has not changed since 2012. It is only a little less than the rate at the end of the recession in 2009. We hear more from Jonathan Evans.
It is the highest food insecurity rate that we've seen, said Alicia Coleman Jensen, who helped write the report. She added that the rate of food insecurity is unusual, because the number should go down when the economy gets better. I have a $1 million question. Who's recovering? Because I'm not seeing the population that's recovering, said Wasita McKinley. She launched a group called Sistas United. It gives food and other help to people near Washington, D.C. Wasita McKinley says there are 2 times as many people coming to her for help now compared to before the recession. It is not only jobless Americans who are having problems. Feeding America is a nationwide organization of food banks. These groups give away food to those in need. Feeding America found that 75% of the people it helps have jobs. It doesn't matter if you work or not. You just don't have enough money to survive, says Grace Davis. Ms. Davis receives help from Sistas United. She teaches in a program for the children of prisoners. But her job does not pay much. She said that she recently did not have enough food to make breakfast for herself and her son. So I said, well, I'll save the eggs for him. And I just drank water and ate bread. The Department of Agriculture found that Ms. Davis is like people in 7 million families that gave up food for one person last year. That number has not changed since 2009. A major reason for food insecurity is the cost of food. Ms. Coleman Jensen says the rate of inflation has been low in recent months, but the price of food has been rising faster than other things. At the same time, an Economic Policy Institute study found that wages have not gone up, especially for American workers whose pay is low. After you pay your electric bill, your car payment, put gas in your car, you don't really have extra money for food, said Sarah Auth. She receives help from Sistas United. As she notes, if you try to eat healthy, healthy food is very expensive. But even food that costs little can be pricey over a long time, says Nancy Roman. She heads the Capital Area Food Bank in Washington. She explains that people who don't eat healthy food may face an increased risk of diseases such as diabetes and heart conditions. Feeding America found that 58% of families they talk to have someone with high blood pressure, and 30% have a person with diabetes. At Sistas United, Wasita McKinley said she has seen people doing all they can to avoid hunger, such as suicide, stealing, and other crimes. We're supposed to be a supernation, a superpower. We're supposed to be the richest nation, she said. Why are we having hungry people in the street? I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. More and more Africans are using text messages, email, and social media to communicate. In Senegal, educators are using new technologies to teach women to read. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, launched the program in Senegal 2 years ago. But UNESCO officials are now expanding it to as many as 6 other African countries. Mariama Dafé sits in front of a television at her home in a community near Senegal's capital, Dakar. She is learning to write and work with numbers. Ms. Dafé started this home study program a year ago. She was 39 years old at the time. The Ministry of Education joined with UNESCO to create these training modules for literacy, reading, and writing. The program appears daily on state television. Women taking part say these lessons have made them more independent. Mariama Dafé says, "These days I have my mobile telephone and I can read messages and I can send messages too." Ms. Dafé finishes her lesson and starts preparing dinner for her husband and 3 children. She says the TV programs are convenient. She studies 3 modules a week, yet she has a full-time job and travels 2 hours by bus every day. At-home study programs are easy to operate and not costly. That makes them especially useful for a place like Senegal, which has limited money to teach literacy. But some women prefer the classroom experience. 10 minutes down the road from Mariama Dafé's home, women write on a chalkboard at the local elementary school. 39-year-old Astu Keita says it is never too late to learn. She says, "My kids laugh at me. They think it is funny that I started learning at this age." Mamadou Diallo is a teacher. He uses a laptop computer and a projector to prepare an interactive display wall. The students use the wall while a class in mathematics is taught. Mr. Diallo says the first time the women saw the interactive display wall, they became very interested. They could not wait to try it. He told them, "First, we need to work on the chalkboard before we can start the math." He asks a student to read a word problem and do the work with numbers. She then answers the mathematical problem on the wall. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Jerry Watson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The battle between the North and the South spread in the summer of 1861. Union soldiers fought pro-Southern rioters in the streets of Baltimore and St. Louis. A Confederate supporter shot and killed a young officer from the North. Untrained soldiers from both sides fought in the mountains of western Virginia. So far, though, the fighting had not claimed many lives, but very soon the battle would become fierce. This week in our series, Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel continue the story of the American Civil War.
The old general who commanded the Union forces, Winfield Scott, did not want to rush his men into battle. Scott believed it would be a long war. He planned to spend the first year of it getting ready to fight. He had an army of thousands of men, and it would get much larger in coming months. But this army was not trained. His soldiers were civilians who knew nothing about fighting a war. General Scott needed time to make soldiers of these men. He also needed time to organize a supply system to get to his forces the guns, bullets, food, and clothing they would need. Without supplies, his army could not fight very long. There were many in the North, however, who thought Scott was too careful. It was true, they said, that Union forces were untrained, but so were those of the South, and the Confederacy's supply problems were even greater than those of the Union. The South had much less industry and fewer railroads. It could not produce as much military equipment, and it could not transport supplies as easily as the North could. In the early months of the war, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, did not even have guns enough for the men in his army. Those who demanded immediate action expected a short war. They said Scott should take the army and march to Richmond. They were sure that if Union forces seized the Confederate capital, the Southern rebellion would end. Northern newspapers took up the cry, "On to Richmond." Political leaders began pressing for a quick Northern victory. Public pressure forced the army to act.
For more than a month, General Irvin McDowell had been building a Union army in Northern Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington. He had more than 30,000 men at bases in Arlington and Alexandria. Late in June, McDowell received orders: march against the Confederate Army of General Pierre Beauregard. Beauregard had 20,000 soldiers at Manassas Junction, a railroad village in Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. McDowell planned to move on Manassas Junction July 9th, but was delayed for more than a week. He planned the attack carefully. McDowell was worried that another large Confederate force west of Manassas Junction might join Beauregard's army. This force, led by General Joe Johnston, was in the Shenandoah Valley near Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Across from Harper's Ferry in Maryland was a Union army almost twice the size of Johnston's.
It was ordered to put pressure on Johnston's force to prevent it from helping Beauregard. General Beauregard received early warning from Confederate spies that McDowell would attack. Much of his information came from a woman, Mrs. Rose O'Neill Greenhow. Mrs. Greenhow, a widow, was an important woman in Washington. She knew almost all the top government officials, and she had friends in almost every department of the government. The beautiful Mrs. Greenhow also had some very special friends. One was Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. He was chairman of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Another special friend was Thomas Jordan, a Confederate colonel in Beauregard's army.
Jordan asked Mrs. Greenhow soon after the war started to be a spy for the South. She agreed and sent much valuable information about Union military plans. Early in July, she sent word to Beauregard that he would be attacked soon. She also sent a map used by the Senate Military Affairs Committee showing how the Union Army would reach Manassas Junction. Then, on the morning of July 16th, Mrs. Greenhow wrote a 9-word message. She gave it to a man to carry to Beauregard. The Confederate general received it that evening. It said, "Order given for McDowell to march upon Manassas tonight."
Beauregard sent a telegram to Richmond. He told the Confederate government that McDowell was on the way. He asked that Johnston's 10,000-man force in the Shenandoah Valley join him for battle. He was told to expect Johnston's help. But Johnston's army was threatened by a large Union force that entered Virginia from Maryland. Led by General Robert Patterson, the Union troops moved toward the smaller Confederate force. They were not really interested in fighting Johnston, but they did want to prevent him from reaching Beauregard. Johnston knew he could not defeat Patterson, so he decided to trick him. While most of his army withdrew and prepared to join Beauregard, Johnston sent a small force to attack Patterson's army. Patterson believed Johnston was attacking with all his troops. He stopped moving forward and prepared to defend against what seemed to be a strong Confederate attack. By the time the trick was discovered, Johnston and most of his troops were at Manassas.
General McDowell's huge Union army left Arlington on the afternoon of July 16th. It was a hot day and the road was dusty. The march was not well organized, and the men traveled slowly. They stopped at every stream to drink and wash the dust from their faces. Some of the soldiers left the road to pick fruits and berries from bushes along the way. To some of those who watched this army pass, the lines of soldiers in bright clothes looked like a long circus parade. Most of these men had not been soldiers long. Their bodies were soft and they tired quickly. It took them 4 days to travel the 45 kilometers to Centerville, the final town before Bull Run. The battle would start the next morning, Sunday, July 21st.
The road from Washington was crowded early Sunday morning with horses and wagons bringing people to watch the great battle. Hundreds of men and women watched the fight from a hill near Centerville. Below them was Bull Run. But the battleground was covered so thickly with trees that the crowds saw little of the fighting. They could, however, see the smoke of battle, and they could hear the sounds of shots and exploding shells. From time to time, Union officers would ride up the hill to report what a great victory their troops were winning. In the first few hours of the battle, Union forces were winning. McDowell had moved most of his men to the left side of Beauregard's army. They attacked with artillery and pushed the Confederate forces back. It seemed that the Confederate defense would break. Some of the Southern soldiers began to run, but others stood and fought. One Confederate officer, trying to prevent his troops from moving back, pointed to a group led by General T.J. Jackson of Virginia. "Look," he shouted, "there is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Fight like the Virginians." The Confederate troops refused to break. The fighting was fierce. The air was full of flying bullets. A newsman wrote that the whole valley was boiling with dust and smoke. A Confederate soldier told his friend, "Them Yankees are just marching up and being shot to hell." Neither side would give up. Then a large group of Johnston's troops arrived by train and joined in the fight. Suddenly, Union soldiers stopped fighting and began pulling back. General McDowell and his officers tried to stop the retreat, but failed. Their men wanted no more fighting.
The fleeing Union soldiers threw down their guns and equipment, thinking only of escape. Many did not stop until they reached Washington. It was a bitter defeat, but it made the North recognize the need for a real army, one trained and equipped for war. President Abraham Lincoln gave the job of building such an army to General George McClellan.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our programs at twitter.com/VOA Learn English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.